On this page, you have a selection of material taken from chapters 11 and 19 of Peter Brown's book, The Body and Society. Here, selections that principally have to do with how the experience of sexual temptation was interpreted and understood in the tradition of the Desert Fathers and St. Augustine. I should add that Brown does a wonderful job of describing in detail in chapter 19, Augustine's approach to this question, and I strongly urge and recommend you to read that whole chapter. But we'll only be looking at a very small portion of it here, from which I wish to emphasize the contrast and even the distinction between the approach taken or the conclusions arrived at by Augustine on the one hand and by Cassian on the other. The first part of this section has to do specifically with the Desert Fathers. I've artificially broken this this page up into two parts, each of which has a kind of a horizontal light-colored bar. There's a number one and a number two. And then within the sections, there are dark blue bars, which are my own commentary and artificial division of these sections as well. So looking at the first section, dealing with the Desert Fathers, what one finds first in the first few paragraphs is a sense of the importance of opening one's heart to a spiritual father or a spiritual mother. This was not a realm of life that one attempted to simply solve by one's self. The understanding or meaning of what was going on within that complex world of the heart is something that needed to be sought in relationship with someone who was experienced and whom one could trust. And notice, as I've highlighted in yellow, these streams of thoughts were symptomatic. Inspirations or even obsessions were symptoms. They were indications of what was going on within the heart. And one needed to understand the logismoi, he calls them powerful trains of thought, usually they're understood in a negative sense as tempting thoughts, through the gift of discernment, diakrisis. And here it's very important to note that the word discernment, diakrisis in antiquity, always meant dialoguing with someone with whom one could work at understanding the deeper meaning or significance of events. Discernment was never undertaken in isolation. Today, especially in the Catholic Church, and I would say especially in religious contexts and in vowed contexts, the word discernment is grossly misapplied to people who are trying to solve their own problems apart from community, apart from spiritual relationship, just working at understanding their own lives. This is not a solitary act in the tradition. It absolutely requires a willingness to work with someone else, and that's how the term is used in the desert tradition. As Brown points out, it's something that you learn to do in relationship with another gifted spiritual guide who helps you see clearly the meaning of one's own, what he calls a stream of consciousness. Now, a very beautiful section, which I've prefaced with that blue bar, number 1.1, is learning to read the book of the heart. And he makes very eloquently here the point that whereas with Origen and the earlier tradition, there was a strong sense of interpreting the scriptures, and even the heart is set on fire by interpreting the scriptures beautifully, within the desert tradition, there's an application of this skill to the inward life. As he puts it, the monk's own heart is the new book. And so one learns to read and understand the movements of the heart. So this is a kind of inward lectio divina, what we've called a lectio on life or on one's own past or on one's own inner experience. The real gift of the desert tradition in the monastic setting to the church was to be able to take these great strides in spiritual and allegorical exegesis or interpretation that had been made in regard to the scriptures and now apply them to the forum of one's own heart. This, as he puts it, is the art of thought, and Brown calls it, in the paragraph a little further down, the greatest and most peculiar or individual achievement of the old men of the desert. And there's no particular fixation on the experience of sexual temptation. Sexual desire is just one of the experiences that gives us information about the heart. Now, it's not the most dangerous. Much more dangerous and problematic were pride, resentment, and ambition. But the experience of sexuality was an important indicator of the inner work or the inner issues. And highlighted here, as we've already mentioned in Cassian and Evagrius, is that in the Desert Fathers, there is always the sense that it is possible to make slow but real progress in the arena of one's spiritual journey and in the area of one's experience of sexuality. Brown calls sexuality an ideogram of the unopened heart. But there will eventually come this grace of a transparent chastity, a gift from Christ that enables the transformation of the heart to be completed. So there is possible a slow but real progress as one learns to look upon and open the interior of the heart. Dropping down towards the end of this section, just before the next horizontal blue bar, sexual thoughts have a pervasiveness, a resilience. They represent an indicator of the deepest and most private recesses of the will, because in some ways this can be the last part of the slowly moving ship of the heart to come into the proper direction. Section 1.3, as I've labeled it here in the next horizontal bar, the body is a witness to spiritual transformation. This is where Brown particularly emphasizes what we hinted at or saw in Cassian, the body or the movements or experiences that happen during sleep can be an indicator of what's going on within the heart. And in a sense, the renunciation, the letting go of self, which monasticism consists in, includes especially a surrendering of sexual fantasy. One has to be willing to surrender to God this inner area of total control and domination so that one can give that over to God and discover, again, what this capacity for reaching out and desiring is really there for, what it's all about. And so in the Desert Fathers tradition, understanding one's experience of inner sexual temptation was also an indication of how much renunciation, how much letting go of my own control I've really done. Because as we saw, if the root of the word porneia has to do with the control of others for my own purposes, then the virtue of chastity means acquiring a control over my own thoughts and a surrendering of a certain quality of control over to God, so that I may become not one who seeks to dominate and control for my own purposes, but instead one who is capable of self-giving, self-emptying. And that is part of what is seen, according to the tradition of the Desert Fathers, by opening one's heart to a spiritual father, being aware of what's going on the inner screen of one's own inner life of fantasy. Now, part two, the selections from pages 417 to 423 have to do primarily with St. Augustine, and here the contrast between the approaches taken by Augustine and that of Cassian. But I need to emphasize, although we're not going to spend as much time as we definitely should on Augustine, that Augustine is often today wrongly accused of having believed, which he did not, that sexuality was the most fallen part of humankind, that concupiscence meant that in one's sexuality one finds the real root of the fall. That's a complete misunderstanding and in fact an injustice to St. Augustine. That's not what Augustine believed. Augustine believed and experienced, as is highlighted in the first couple of paragraphs, that sexuality mirrors a fissure within the soul, that it reveals concupiscentia carnis, it reveals the flaw in the soul, but it is not in any sense the most fallen part of the self. Augustine did not believe that one's sexuality was any more fallen or broken or tending towards wrong actions than one's capacity for anger or one's ability to love or anything else. It's just that for Augustine, it is in the experience of one's sexuality that one experiences most clearly, and this is mentioned in this chapter but not in the text that I've quoted here, there one experiences the difference between what is willed on the one hand and what one actually desires on the other. If we were perfect, as we were in original integrity, Augustine says, and again, you can find this elsewhere in chapter 19, we were originally created so that we would only desire that which we should properly will. But now, after the fall, We want things which are not good for us. Our will does not accord with our desires, whether it's desires for things or for food or for sex. But Augustine says, if you want to experience this most sharply and acutely, it is in our experience of sexuality that we can deny it least. There we experience clearly the disjunction between what we ought to desire and what we actually desire, but between what we know we should will and what we actually want. So for Augustine, as for Cassian, sexuality is a mirror, but for Augustine it's a particularly valuable mirror because it reveals so indisputably the nature of one's fallenness. It's not that sexuality is more fallen, but that it reveals it so clearly. There's a very beautiful description of concupiscence in its full sense in a white highlighted text. The dark drive to control, to appropriate, to turn to one's private ends, all the good things created by God, which would be should be accepted with gratitude and shared with others. Concupiscence is the desire to control, to appropriate, to have as mine what should be shared and freely given. And in our sexuality, we have a mirror, a glimpse of ourselves. Now, if we drop down a little further, the difference, the big distinction between Augustine and Cassian, and I'd invite you to read this section on your own, and indeed, Brown is worthy of many rereadings because of his very clear insight into these authors and his brilliant ability to formulate their thought in such succinct ways. I've asked the question, is sexuality, as Augustine would say, primarily a mirror of estrangement from God and from each other, or is, as Cassian and the Desert Fathers would say, is it an indicator of spiritual progress, how much work we need to do? Because Cassian and the Desert Fathers believed that a real progress was possible. I've highlighted the text that came from one of the Desert Fathers, from Abba Paphnutius, that sexuality was implanted by the will of the Lord not to injure us, but to help us. We have to believe that this is given to us by God for a reason. And then here's a repetition of what we've already seen. Sexual fantasy informs the monks of the movement of forces that lie beneath immediate consciousness. They let us know how much work yet needs to be done on purity of heart. They're like feeling the pulse of a patient. And I've highlighted that text as well. Whereas for Augustine, sexuality echoes in the body with terrible precision the consequences of our first fall, and Augustine's experience of the meaning of sexuality was not that we are capable of this real transformation, this real change, which the Desert Fathers and Cassian emphasize, but instead we are constantly reminded of our fallenness, invited to repent, and to believe in our absolute necessity and dependence on the grace of God. Whereas Cassian, as again is highlighted, was convinced that the very depths of the person could shift. And again, I strongly recommend going back to these chapters and rereading them, but I wanted to highlight these as particularly important texts for our study of this subject.